This is an amazing podcast, one you will not want to miss if you are worried about the coronavirus. I interviewed Dr. Todd Hayes, an ER doctor from Kansas City, and he will give you a personal account on how an ER doctor is approaching the coronavirus. It's information that I found fascinating and illuminating. Granted, I don't watch too many doctor/hospital shows, so my medical IQ is not exactly at the top of the class level. In fact, I am much closer to the why is that sixth grader shaving part of the class when it comes to my medical knowledge. But his information is highly helpful in these uncertain times. Plus, just because the world is homebound does not mean that there are not crazy legal stories to cover. Lori Loughlin's case just got a lot stronger as evidence was uncovered that cops lie. Yeah, who knew? Plus, the NFL is asking the Supreme Court to hear its case that its anti-competitive policies are not really the bad kind of anti-competitive, but rather just the kind that allows billionaires to become bajillionaires and keep hiking up the price for the consumer in a legal fashion. Plus, we uncover some interesting cases involving license plates. Yeah, we go from news about the end of the world as we know it to license plates. The law touches everything in this week's debriefing of the law. Welcome to today's podcast, and I got to tell you, I am excited about today's podcast. I interviewed a good friend of mine, Dr. Todd Hayes, on how an ER doctor faces the coronavirus. I know for myself, I am holed up here in my basement doing podcasts and teaching classes. I can exist quite well in the confines of my basement, but an ER doctor, yeah, they don't have that luxury. They're out there on the front line, so I found his information really fascinating. But before we get there, it's time to pay the bills. And today's podcast is brought to you by Digital Directory Management. Now, in the pre-apocalypse days, I traveled the United States teaching classes, and I was on the road quite a bit, and I would go out and eat at restaurants and find entertainment things to do in hotels, and I relied almost exclusively on the veracity of the information I found on the internet. In fact, did you know that 73% of consumers lost trust in a local business when they found incorrect information about that business online? I sure know I did. If this company said they were open at 8 o'clock and I get there at 8:30 and they're not open, I'm pretty much assuming that business is going bankrupt. Well, nonetheless, that is why Digital Directory Management exists. They connect businesses with consumers at the national, local, and hyper-local levels by ensuring the accuracy and visibility of your business's location information on top search engines, directories, apps, and social networks. So contact Digital Directory Management to make sure your company is up to date with this information. You can reach them at www.digitaldirectory.management. Again, that's www.digitaldirectory.management. Well, in today's podcast, again, we are going to interview Dr. Todd Hayes. I interviewed him the other day, and I found his information fascinating. So without further ado, let's go to that interview. Well, today's guest is a good friend of mine, Todd Hayes. Todd, thank you for joining us on the show today.
Nice to be here, Joel.
Now, you are a lifelong friend, but that's not why I had you on the show today. You are an ER doctor on the front line facing the coronavirus. And so, but before we get there, I want to just introduce you to our listeners, because according to my sons, you are like Mr. Cool. Do you have any idea why you are Mr. Cool?
Probably because I make things at my house. I'm a maker, so I make electronic doodads and gadgets and that sort of thing. I'm just guessing.
Nothing to do with it. You're Mr. Tesla.
No, okay. Oh, yes.
You are on the front lines, letting the computer just drive your car wherever you are. And pretty soon you're going to talk into your watch and say, hey, now, Todd, do you have a name for your Tesla?
It's actually called Bob.
Bob. Okay, so you're going to look and talk into your watch. Hey, Bob, come pick me up. I'm here at the front of the grocery store. I don't want to walk to you, and Bob is going to come pick you up. How far away are you from that?
Oh, it's a ways, because with your iPhone, you can say, come get me, but you have to hold the button down the whole time. So I'm sure it'll be a while. But if you do hold the button down in the test lab, it will come get you to the best of its ability.
So right now, you can go to a grocery store, say, come get me, and it will do it.
Yeah, within the app. You have to literally hold your button on the come get me button. But yes, it will do it. And honestly, it probably works 60% of the time. I use it at work. It's great when it's raining out or it's snowing, because then you don't have to walk to the parking lot.
Wait a second. It works 60% of the time. So 40%, what, it's hitting pedestrians? What do you mean it doesn't work 40% of the time?
It doesn't hit anything. Stop where it is and get confused or something. Sometimes it'll park in a different spot. One of my coworkers has the same vehicle. We have about the same success rate at the hospital with it coming to pick us up. So, you know, it works more than not, but it's far from perfect.
Hey, when it comes to self-driving cars, 60%, hey, more likely than not, it's actually going to get you to your destination. Not bad odds, I guess, if you're a doctor.
Right.
Yeah, no, so
right.
That's why you're Mr. Cool. In your car, you have your Tesla. It shows up on your little screen. Is that correct?
Correct. Yeah. Uh-huh.
So what icon are you, if I'm using the right term? Are you still a pizza?
There's no icon. I mean, it still just shows up as a regular Tesla.
All right, so Todd, what I'm talking about is one time I was in your car, you were giving me a test ride, and there on your screen, I could see your car, and it looked like a pizza. I mean, it was actually a pizza driving the streets of Kansas City. Again, am I crazy? Am I not remembering this correctly?
I don't think you're remembering it correctly, but you can be Santa Sleigh, you can be a Mars rover. I think there's one other, but I think that's it. There's no pizza option.
All right, so what are you?
Oh, I'm just the generic black Tesla, that's all.
All right, well, I was hoping you're a little bit more exciting than that, but nonetheless, you drive a Tesla, so you're my boy's hero there. They're dying to get their own Tesla.
Stay in school.
Now, you you have a 3D printer. You're also kind of a gadget kind of guy. Always are building things on the cutting edge of technology. What is the last thing that you printed on your 3D printer?
So interesting you ask. Currently what I'm printing is a holder for a UVC germicidal light so that I can sterilize things. And so you can get bare bulbs from China, but you have no way to sort of use them. And so it's literally just think of it like a lightsaber handle or something that you could then put the bulb into and then use it like a wand to sterilize things. So that's what's printing right now as we do this interview.
Well, back up there. Unpack what you just said, because you shot right over my head. So I heard lightsaber and I got all excited. But then you're saying it's some kind of sterilizer. So what is it that you are designing? And should we be talking in patent right after this interview?
No. So literally like UVC light, which is in things like aquariums or HVAC units to sterilize the air, sterilize the water. So they're commonly used in lots of things.
So a UVC light can actually sterilize things.
Correct. Or kill germs and bacteria. I don't know if it means sterilizing limits, but yeah, it actually kills the bacteria and the viruses on it, like Corona.
It can kill the coronavirus. So you walk out from the grocery store, you get your lightsaber out, and you scan your hands. Todd, this is cool. So when is it going to be done?
Yeah. Roughly 5 hours from now. But we're using it right now just in a generic lamp base with a Kleenex box over it, because you have to be careful where the light goes, because UVC light does cause cancer and cataracts, so you can't let it hit your eyes and scan things like that. So, but it is a real use thing, and you can actually get the portable ones like you're talking about. That you could actually, when you walk out of the grocery store, a little USB powered thing, and you could wand your grocery stuff like that. They're all sold out, but I mean, those exist right now.
So your options would be coronavirus or cancer. And in today's day and age, I'm not sure which one people would pick. But so you're just saying you got to be careful where you point this device.
Absolutely. And wear some gloves and sunglasses. But if your skin's covered and you got sunglasses on and you don't point it directly at your face, you should be fine.
Hey, this is just like a lightsaber. You got to be careful where you point those as well.
Absolutely.
All right, well, that was a nice segue into the coronavirus and what you do. But You're a doctor. In fact, you are an ER doctor. Is that not correct?
Correct. Yeah, I work at St. Luke's here in Kansas City.
Now, Todd, we've been lifelong friends, but I'm trying to go back in my memory here of why you became an ER doctor. Was it this whole George Clooney fascination you had growing up? Tell me why you decided to become an ER doctor.
Excellent question. Probably the long and short of it would be that I wanted to be able to do things, in other words, procedures, but not have to be on call all the time like general surgery and vascular surgery was. So this was the right mix. If I was a internal medicine hospital doctor, for the most part, I wouldn't get to do things. So with emergency medicine, you still get to do that, but you also don't have to be on call 24/7.
I see. And I like that aspect. Another friend of mine is a geriatrics doctor. And yeah, he still has to do his runs at the ER every morning at the hospital, checking up on his patients, and then going to his office to do his office duties, his office hours. But I guess you get to go to the ER, live the George Clooney life, and doing whatever the exciting things that happen at the ER, because come on. They make great TV shows based upon the ER. I've never seen a doctor's TV show based upon the in-house office visits. Am I not describing
that
accurately?
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, that's right. And the great thing about the TV shows is stuff that we might see, you know, in a year's time all gets condensed into 1 hour so that you think that's really what happens and not that it's spread out over a long time. But anyway, yeah.
So you're telling me actual ER life is not like what's portrayed on the TV screen?
It's not all in the same night, no. That's not in Kansas City, it's not. Maybe in Cook County, you know, in Chicago, but no. Here in Kansas City, we see lots of crazy stuff, but we don't see it the same night every night like you do on television. But it also would be boring television if it was like this, where some of the stuff just isn't exciting. It's normal stuff.
No, that is the truth. You know, I'm a lawyer, and so that's one of my fascinations is how Hollywood misrepresents the legal profession. But as you pointed out, you got to do that to make it interesting because you actually watched a real courtroom drama. Drama would not be the right word. It's slow moving.
Yeah, Joel, a quick fact about emergency medicine. So on television, if you see someone get CPR and shocked and all that, generally works 95% of the time. In real life, it's about 16% of the time.
16%?
Yeah. Even for a witnessed arrest in the hospital, that's all it really is. And so, but on television, it's really common.
It's common.
Everything always works.
That is true because, hey, we've already fallen in love with that character. Don't kill off that character. We like him.
Exactly.
We want the story to end positively. So,
exactly.
Right. Well, Todd, obviously the entire world is in grip now with the coronavirus. And so, well, we are all connected to social media. So now we are quasi experts on the coronavirus. I like to think of myself as being somewhat, well, I'm not an expert, but hey, I read a lot up on it. But you are actually on the front lines. I'm kind of holed out here in my basement. I built a studio for my podcast in my classes. And so there is pretty much no way the coronavirus is going to get to me. But you're out there at the ER every day. How is it that you go to work every day? What's going through your mind?
Oh, I mean, it's certainly stressful because it's really tough right now. And this isn't just true in Kansas City, but, you know, for all healthcare providers, you know, someone's got to go do it. And so if we don't do it, then it's just not going to get done and people need to be taken care of. And that's why we got in this profession. So a lot of times that can be stressful. And then sometimes you face other challenges. And let's be honest, a lot of the procedures and protocols are changing daily because no one's ever seen this or been through a pandemic. And there's not enough of this or that, or, you know, best laid plans go south. I mean, it's just, there's no pattern for this or history. And so a lot of it, you just work out on the fly as you go. And hope that it works out well and apply common sense, things like that. But obviously stressful for a lot of us.
Do they teach pandemic medicine or procedures in med school?
I don't recall anything specific. I mean, you talk about infectious diseases and how many people are killed and basic concepts. But, you know, other than maybe some disaster planning type of stuff, you know, in emergency medicine specifically, no, I don't necessarily think there was, because let's face it, the odds of you ever having to know how to do it and respond are so slim. I think the last major pandemic that actually killed a lot of people was 100 years ago. There have been pandemics since then, but actually widespread, all that kind of stuff. I mean, it just hasn't been that way. So again, there are those that specialize. We do get some of that in emergency medicine as well, how to prepare, disaster preparedness. I mean, we do a lot of disaster preparedness for things like, you know, bombs going off or mass casualties or whatever. But the infectious disease part, I don't know, you get a small amount, but you just hardly don't ever get to practice it to reinforce it.
So someone comes to the ER and they think they have the coronavirus. What does that look like? What kind of processes or treatments are available for someone going to the ER today thinking they have the coronavirus?
So that's a good question. That's one of the things that's changing. But so one of the big things is everyone wants to get tested, which is totally reasonable. The truth of it is there aren't enough test kits to do all the testing.
Hold on a second. Why is that reasonable? Because I don't understand that. My thought is the number one treatment is you stay at home, and then when it gets bad, you venture out. So why would I, if I get the coronavirus, why would I want to get tested? Why don't I just stay at home and stay locked up?
Ultimately, that is all that matters, what you're saying. And what people don't realize is you're right. Whether the test is positive or negative, it doesn't change anything trajectory-wise. There's no treatment, nothing like that. It seems to be that for a lot of folks, knowing if they have it somehow brings peace of mind. Some of us think that maybe if they do get tested, even though they're not going to get a result back for, let's be honest, 5 days, maybe they will be quarantined. I mean, we are really perplexed. I mean, most of the docs I work with are really perplexed because we don't know the right answer. Frequently, people come to the emergency department totally unrelated to coronavirus, and they want to know why they have chest pain, abdominal pain, fill in the blank, and they want answers. And even if we can't give it to them because we're an emergency department and we're looking for life-threatening emergencies, and sometimes we just don't know, that doesn't sit well with people. And frequently, they'd rather have you have fill in the blank disease as opposed to we don't know. And so being told that they have coronavirus, you know, specifically, again, it's more like peace of mind, but you're right. It absolutely does not change any management or treatment. And quite frankly, those with or without coronavirus, it's still stay at home, quarantine yourself. I mean,
right. Now, I guess you would not.
That's the truth of it. Yeah.
I guess you would. You could then tell the people who you've been around, "Hey, I had the coronavirus and I was over at your house." But since we are all in under a quarantine right now, anyways, I'm not sure how that really impacts things. But like you said, sometimes it's nice to know, and so that way, when you feel something in your chest and you know that you have coronavirus, well, maybe it is time to go to the hospital. And so let's say you get to that point. And Todd, actually, this is somewhat personal for me. I don't know if I've told you this before, but you know her, my cousin, Lori Blakely. Went into the doctors for knee surgery, minor knee surgery. Knee surgeries are extremely successful, no problem whatsoever. They asked her, you know, if she had any problems. And so for whatever reason, at that point in time, she actually had H1N1, did not realize it. And so you combine H1N1 with a minor knee surgery, and she passed away from it. So this actually is a real serious thing. But so let's get to the point where someone then goes to the ER, the doctors, because they have coronavirus. At what point should they go to the doctors?
Well, certainly, if you can't breathe, you need to come in.
That would be a good indicator, I would think.
But we would tell you, even if there is no coronavirus on the planet, you need to come in if you can't breathe.
So you mean like struggling with breathing, right? Not like literally, I can't breathe. But if you struggle to breathe,
right? If you're breathing 30 times a minute as an adult, there's probably something wrong there that you need to get checked out.
Really? How often do we breathe? I had no idea.
Well, I mean, most people, it's 10 to 20.
We breathe 10 to 20 times per minute.
Correct. That's the average person.
Okay. So you're saying if we're breathing 30 times a minute.
Right.
Now, so I unpack that for you. I have no idea what you just said. So You mean I'm breathing quicker because I'm not actually getting oxygen into my lungs, so I'm gasping for air, so I'm struggling to breathe?
Well, that's the short version. Yeah, I mean, if you can't get oxygen into your bloodstream because you've got so much fluid in your lungs from coronavirus or whatever, every breath you take, only so much gets in your bloodstream, and so you make up for it by breathing faster, or your heart just beats that much quicker to circulate the blood around your body. So your heartbeat gets fast and you breathe fast to compensate for it.
Okay.
And so if you're a healthy person, you're not going to breathe 30 times a minute unless something's wrong. You could even try it now, breathe 30 times a minute. Eventually you're going to get lightheaded and pass out, and then that'll be how your brain resets it. I mean, you can't do it on purpose. You would only do it because you need to. You can't continuously do it. It just doesn't work.
Oh, trust me. As soon as we're done with this interview, I'm going to try it because I am curious. I had no idea how often I actually breathe.
Yeah, that's right. Eventually, you just pass out because your brain says you don't need to breathe 30 times a minute. You're fine. But if you're not getting oxygen to your brain and other parts, then it's just like a natural reflex that you would breathe 30 times a minute. And, you know, for any of those listening out there that may have like respiratory problems like emphysema, COPD, you might be breathing 25 times a minute or 30 on a good day, but you also know a lot more about your normal patterns. But for the average healthy person, that would be very abnormal to breathe that often per minute.
Okay, so you're struggling breathing. You're up in the 30 range, but it's a struggle. So you go to the ER. What's going to happen?
So you're going to get a mask on as soon as you enter the place, and then I mean, everyone's getting screened right now anyway. Again, even if you come for abdominal pain, if you have a fever and cough, and put on a mask. But if you do have, shortness of breath and fever symptoms that seem infectious, then try to isolate you. And then some places have even got it down to where they can isolate all those patients into the same area. That kind of varies by facility. But then evaluates you.
But I can be isolated at home, so why am I going to the doctor to be isolated? I mean, you're going to put me on a ventilator? What's going on?
Well, yeah, that's what I mean. I mean, literally, when you get there, we isolate you with the other patients that have it, but also evaluate you. I mean, we do things like chest x-ray, blood work, check your vitals, that kind of stuff, and, you know, see if your oxygen level is really low, so you're breathing really fast, but your oxygen's low. There's clearly something wrong. Do you need to be on supplemental oxygen, like the cannula that goes in your nose? If you can't catch up, then we put you on a ventilator to breathe for you, that sort of thing.
Okay, so you're put on a ventilator to help you breathe. What's the end game there, that your body will then just fight this virus off and you're letting that body stay alive long enough to be able to fight it off? Is that the thought process there?
Yeah, I mean, literally to oxygenate your blood so that your body can fight the virus off. Since there's no proven treatment, there are some indications that things like Plaquenil and some retroviral drugs work. But yeah, for the most part, it's your body's going to have to beat it anyway, kind of like you do with influenza. Most people are able to fight off influenza on their own. If they can't breathe enough, they get put on oxygen or a ventilator while your body does the work itself.
See, Todd, in all my years of knowing you, I had no idea you were so smart. I mean, I'm that stupid. I have no idea, but this is news to me. So the body's fighting this off, and you're just trying to help the body stay alive long enough so that it can do its job.
Yeah. I mean, that's literally how it works. Yes.
And that's why, just again, generally speaking, I know there are all kinds of specific, everyone's individual character situation, but generally speaking, the younger, healthier people are surviving this at a much higher rate than older people, just because your system is stronger, your immunity system is better able to fight off infections. Is that a gross generalization that might be accurate?
Yeah, it's very true. And it's really interesting. For some reason, kids under the age of 19 have not gotten nearly as sick. I mean, they still can get infected like anyone else, but for some reason, we would still expect more of them to get sick, but they're not. Usually it's the extremes of age that they get hit hardest. But for some reason, as a rule, under 18 has not got hit as hard as we would expect. There seems to be more in the younger, the sort of 20 to 40 age group that end up in the hospital because they don't appear to be social distancing as well as they're supposed to. But they're still able to recover, that sort of thing. people over, I think it's 50 is now sort of the cutoff where they're harder hit. And of course, obviously, if you're much older, it's much worse.
Did you say 50?
It is, yeah.
Todd, we're close, man. This is not good. You and I are close.
I know. That was the last cutoff I saw, that where it seems like if you're over 50, but again, most people are over 50 are still going to do fine. I mean, you can still have no symptoms, literally no symptoms. That's part of what's so scary. You can be infected and a carrier, but not have any symptoms. And so you could go about your business and pass it to people. That's why they're doing social distancing and quarantine, so that even people will not unknowingly pass it on.
Well, let's go there. That's a good segue to there, because I got to tell you, I told Wendy I was going to interview you today, and Wendy's first thought was, heck no, is he coming over to the house? I said, no, don't worry. We're going to do this via the telephone. But the thought there is, how do you do social distancing? Now, I've tried the whole garlic approach. The more garlic I eat, people don't want to come close to me. I haven't showered in days. That's an effective way to do it, even in one's house. But from a more medical certainty standpoint, how, as an ER doctor, how do you do social distancing?
Well, I don't think social distancing with your coworkers is very difficult. I'll be real honest, because it's just not practical. But as far as like the patients and
have you tried not showering?
Well, yeah, but I mean, you still have to be within less than 6 feet with people. I mean, it's just, you can't. And so, but you know, we're having to go through these extremes, wearing gowns and gloves and masks and goggles and all this business when you're in around patients that you know have it.
Are you wearing goggles there at the ER?
I don't, because I have glasses, but okay. If you don't wear glasses, yes, you have to wear goggles. Think like science lab, Bunsen burner, those kind of goggles.
Wow, okay.
There's also masks that have like the plastic shield on and that sort of thing. Some people wear those.
This is fascinating.
But yeah. So doing those kind of things.
Let's just say you go to the grocery store. What is Todd Hayes doing at the grocery store? I say, Dr. Todd Hayes, go on.
No, it's not that. I just, you know, I can tell you when I ran to Target, I didn't do anything special other than I made sure I washed my hands thoroughly. I mean, most of the spread is through droplets anyway. So, you know, unless somebody's coughing right next to you into your mouth, your chance of getting it is pretty slim. Some people wear masks and that's okay, but for sure we know it's on surfaces. So when I ran to Target and picked up whatever, I didn't touch my face while I was in the store, bought all my stuff, put it in my car, immediately wiped my hands down. You know, if you can find hand sanitizer left, if not Clorox, wipes. And then when we get in the house, wipe everything off with Clorox wipes, all the stuff you bought, that sort of thing. Wash your hands and just don't touch your face until you get all that business done.
Speaking of hand sanitizer, we're opening up some cupboard today, a cupboard we had not opened up in a while, and boom, we found 4 things of hand sanitizer. We thought we had hit the jackpot. I'm just like, are you serious? 4 different containers of hand sanitizer.
That's liquid gold, man.
I know. Probably 5 years old. Who knows how long it's been there, but hey.
Oh, it works. It's alcohol. It still works.
All right, good. We're good to go there. So, all right. Any other thoughts on the how Dr. Hayes goes about doing social distancing?
You just do the best you can and don't take unnecessarily steps. And I, if you read my wife's Facebook post, you'll see that she's basically set up the dirty area. So you come in from the garage, and anything you bring in with you gets wiped down or, you know, wanded with UVC light. And if you've been out for a long time, or like me at work, you take a shower, throw everything you have into the washer, basically try to leave a dirty area that can be wiped down with Clorox wipes or whatever you use. So that by the time you enter the main part of the house, in theory, you're as clean as you're going to get and not going to spread it to anyone.
All right. Well, I'll tell you what, I really do appreciate this information. This has been very illuminating to myself. I hope also to the listeners. So I do want to just end on a couple of maybe lighter moments, because if we don't have the lighter moments, well, then we're just being miserable over the next 4 weeks. But since we do have time on our hands, Todd, you have to know about the good doctor shows. So what are you watching on TV? I want to know 2 things. Number one, your favorite all-time doctor show. And then secondly, what are you watching right now when it comes to doctor shows?
I'm sure I watched ER. I mean, that's probably my favorite. You know, before I was actually a doctor, but anyway, probably that. You know, everybody likes a good House doctor, you know, House case okay. or something, because he would always come up with stuff. As far as doctor shows, I don't really watch them anymore, because usually, like most of us, we see a case and we're like, this is not hard. Why are they dragging out a full hour? If you're so smart, why wouldn't you know that? That kind of stuff. So I don't get into that stuff anymore now.
Oh, man, it would be hilarious to watch a doctor show with you then. Because I'm kind of the same way with lawyer shows. I'll tell Wendy, this is ridiculous. There's no way that argument would ever be, you know, make its way into court. What are they doing here? They're just sensationalizing this. Well, of course, they're trying to get ratings. Well,
or like Grey's Anatomy, where each doctor apparently has five subspecialties and can cross all borders or whatever and do this, that, and the other, which in the real world, nobody does multiple specialties, you know, unless you live in a farm town or something. But, you know, other than that, everyone else just kind of does their thing and that's it. They don't do everything under the sun within an hour also.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Hayes. I appreciate your great insight information. Hope to have you on in the future, because I do want to hear your thoughts on our main thought of there is freedom from the law. And so debriefing the law concept. I know you have your opinions on when it comes to the law and freedom from the law from a theological standpoint. So we'll have you on in the future to talk about that.
All right, man. Sounds good.
Thanks so much. Stay safe.
All right. Thanks, Joel.
Well, Lori Loughlin was in the news again, and this time things are looking up for Aunt Becky. Recent developments show that the FBI yelled at and instructed Rick Singer, who was the mastermind behind this pay-for-play college bribery scheme, to lie. The FBI wanted him to say that their payments would be bribes and not legitimate donations to the schools. Now, I am not up on my criminal procedures. I'm not really in that criminal world, but I do watch a lot of crime shows on TV. But I am guessing that most criminal conspirators are not in the game of spelling out the crime before it happens. Yeah, that's right. Put in that check memo, bribes to get punk kids into college. I mean, no, when police are looking over a suspect's bank drafts, they are not looking for payments deposited to Assassins R Us. I am just guessing that criminals like to be a little bit more discreet when it comes to outlining their criminal intent. And so I am just probably guessing that Rick Singer did not spell out the criminal implications to Aunt Becky when this thing went down. Well, there is more to come on this, but I am thinking if Aunt Becky plays her cards right here, she has a new made-for-TV movie in the works. Maybe Hallmark can do a new crime series during its off-Christmas season times. I don't know. Stay tuned, and we will surely be following Hallmark's upcoming offerings. Also recently, the NFL is asking the United States Supreme Court to take up its case so that it can continue violating the antitrust laws. Now, that might be an overreach. Let me just unpack what the legal issue is in that case. So right now, the NFL has a collection of various companies and organizations. We also call them teams. So the Kansas City Chiefs, the Dallas Cowboys, the New England Patriots, all these are various NFL teams. They get together and they decide how they are going to do the business of the NFL. Now, normally, various businesses cannot get together to decide prices and terms and conditions of what they're going to offer to the public or enter into any kind of agreement that might be viewed as being anti-competitive and limiting the offering of one's services to the public. That does control supply. It impacts the pricing. Well, here what happened was the NFL and these various teams reached an agreement to limit their TV offerings to in various markets. For example, in a local TV group, let's say the Kansas City Chiefs, they can only offer up their team's broadcast in their local market, but they could not offer up, let's just say, the Buffalo Bills games in Kansas City. Now, you might be wondering, why would anyone in Kansas City want to watch the Buffalo Bills games? Touche, good point, but that is how the current agreement works. Well, That's also anti-competitive. What if there are some Buffalo Bills fans here in Kansas City that wanted to watch those games? Well, what they would have to do is go to DirecTV and buy the NFL ticket. Aha! That's exactly what the NFL wants. They can up the price on the NFL ticket. Well, yeah, that's kind of the whole reason why you have the antitrust rules to prohibit various companies in an industry from pooling together their collective thoughts to restrict something, whether it be the supply that has an anti-competitive effect and thus ups the prices for the consumer. And so an appeals court ruled that, yeah, this agreement to restrict the broadcasting of shows there in a local market, that is anti-competitive. We should allow this lawsuit to go forward. Well, that is why the NFL is now going to the Supreme Court saying, can you please take up this case? We want to continue raking in the bucks from these local consumers, or else why exist as the NFL? Well, we started this podcast with what could be the apocalypse, the sign of the end of the times. We're going to end it with license plate news. So, yes, we are going to run the full gamut of information because that's what we do here at Comedian of Law's Debriefing of the Law. We bring it all to you and let you decide whether or not it is relevant to your life. But on to these license plate cases. I found this case in Louisiana where this guy was pulled over by the cops for having an expired tag. Maybe that has happened to you and you got busy. And so all of a sudden the date came by where you were to renew your tag. You forgot to do that. A cop pulls up behind you, pulls you over, and then you realize, yes, I forgot to renew my tags. Well, that's kind of what happened here to this Louisiana guy, but he forgot to renew his tags for over 20 years. Yes, on his license plate, it was last renewed September of 1997. When he was asked, why did it take you so long to renew your tags? He said, well, I got busy and just forgot. I gotta tell you, I would love to interview his wife. I would love to hear those excuses that he has given in his household. Hey, look, I'm going to fix the lights. I'll get to it one of these days. You don't have to remind me every 23 years. In other license plate news, a Canadian court recently ruled that this guy's license plate was offensive and so rescinded his personalized license plate. Now, this person's last name was Grabher. I don't know how you really pronounce that, but it's G-R-A-B-H-E-R. And so on his personalized license plate, it says Grabher, G-R-A-B-H-E-R. He got this license plate in 1990, has had it with no consequence or events for over, what, this almost now 30 years since it was first issued. Well, a couple of years ago, someone anonymously complained about his license plate and said it was sexist. Apparently, if you say though that his last name slowly and you put a pause in there, it also could be said grab her and not Grabber. And so they complained about his license plate and said it was offensive, and in a Canadian court agreed and rescinded his license plate. Well, he has appealed that now to a higher court there in Canada, but that just goes to show you, we start off by talking about the end of the world, and we end with a license plate case where someone's last name is offensive and can't be on the back of a car. Well, thank you for listening to today's podcast. If you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a 5-star review. We need your love to help us continue highlighting the funnier side of the law. I want to give a special shout out to our Vice President of Operations, Wendy Oster, without whom, well, let's just face it, this entire operation would be a mess. Our marketing team of Red Bird Solutions and Leanne Holmberg for spreading the good word about us. Sean Wynn and 15.5 Features for making me sound way better than I actually do. By the way, Sean, one of these days, I want to get that James Earl Jones voice. Keep working at it. And then finally, Ryan Kuhn and Paul Kuhn of Triplicity Marketing for our technical and computer support.